I'm very pleased to welcome back to the first podcast for the year 2026, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
Welcome back, Michael, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners. And it's good to be here in 2026.
It is, isn't it? We're just reflecting off screen, to the side, how you're not quite sure what's going to happen next in the world. When we were younger, momentous things happened, and you take it all in much later when you're older, I suppose. I'm thinking of what my granddaughters from 21 to 10 are making of the world at the moment. But when they're closer to your age and my age, they'll be having the same reflections. Martin, the last weekly edition of the Fremantle Shipping News went out on the 19th of December. You're already in Italy, or coming back from about that time, and that weekly edition was preceded by the terrible massacre at Bondi, and now it's been announced yesterday by the Prime Minister that there will be a Federal Royal Commission into it, and the New South Wales Royal Commission that was going to be held has been abandoned by New South Wales Premier Chris Minns. It was always coming, I think, the Royal Commission, but let's talk about the Royal Commission and let's come to the rest of the geopolitics, Venezuela, Greenland, what's going on in the rest of the world a little bit later in our discussion. But were you surprised that there wasn't a Royal Commission called pretty much straight away by the
Yes,
Fed?
I was surprised. I think the Prime Minister's been quite reluctant to do so and faced increasing pressure. I thought probably the most important intervention was not a series of sports stars that might have lent their voice to this, but the letter from the victims of Bondi that said that they wanted answers. And I think that's really the driving force here. I think it was inevitable. I think people do want answers. There's a range of different types of answers. There's the how, and the how is around how did someone who's on ASIO's watch list get a hold of that many guns with his father? How was he given the opportunity? What led to that particular attack? And then there's the why, and that's where anti-Semitism comes in, and where Jewish groups are bringing that up, and they want answers in that respect as well. So I think this has been inevitable for some time, and I think probably the Prime Minister should have got onto it quicker. So he's lost some political skin here.
Yes, it's the politics of it, but in a very little p, very broad sense for me, namely that this is such a terrible event that just having some senior and highly skilled public sector people, public servants, people like Dennis Richardson, who knows the ASIO security world very well, is not enough. There has to be some healing. There has to be some release of tension around all of this. So it was that failure to, in a sense, read the politics of what was required that surprised me a little. I got some of the answers or the PM's point about royal commissions can last a long time. I have skin in that game. I was one of the council assisting the WA Inc. Royal Commission. It was meant to last for a year, Martin, when it was set up, and we were given very specific terms of reference, and they were big, and it went on, and as others have said, inevitably royal commissions get delayed and they can take time and they cost a lot of money and you bring in the lawyers and you bring in all the other experts and everyone wants to be heard. But it seems to me you just have to have it and it'll be well managed by Virginia Bell, former High Court judge, and it'll have people who are busy about it. I noticed that Michelle Rowland, the Federal Attorney General, has confirmed that the commission will cover four key areas. The first one, tackling anti-Semitism by investigating the nature and prevalence of it generally in our institutions and in the country. Secondly, making recommendations that will assist law enforcement, border control, immigration, and security agents to tackle anti-Semitism. And you've sort of adverted to this, how this all happened. The third is examining the particular circumstances surrounding the anti-Semitic Bondi terrorist attack on the 14th of December. And then finally, making any other recommendations arising out of the inquiry for strengthening social cohesion in Australia and countering the spread of ideologically and religiously motivated extremism in Australia, which I think a lot of people would say in many ways is a really important part of the inquiry, because when you come down on smaller groups in our society, whether they be Jews, whether they be Muslims, whether they be whomever, you run into the same problem. You don't want a one size fits all. We have to be a true multicultural society, do we not?
Oh, absolutely. And I think yeah, that's really essential. And I think there is a need. There's been a lot of political debate in the aftermath of Bondite, and at some stage there needs to be some agreed pathways forward. And people need to work together to ensure that nothing like this ever happens again. So I think let's hope the Royal Commission is able to pull those different strands together and develop a really good pathway, a set of recommendations that will help.
I mean, there is a danger, but I don't think it's a real one, that by providing a platform like a Royal Commission and giving people the right to speak to these four broad issues, that you actually encourage some really awful anti-Semitic talk in the community or anti-Islamic talk in the community. But I'm sure, as I say, whilst at risk, it's something that'll be properly managed.
Yeah, I think that has to be a risk that you have to take in order to tackle something head on like this. And Jewish groups will say that they've had their schools targeted, they've had their community centres targeted, they've had synagogues firebombed, a whole range of things leading up to this. So they're really adamant that they'd like to see this tackled head on. And they've made it clear that the Bondi massacre was really the latest in a chain of events, which is why I think they're really they've pushed for the Royal Commission.
Fremantle Shipping News posted an open letter that 11 groups, including nine Jewish groups, Martin, have sent to the Governor General and the Prime Minister, suggesting that they shouldn't be having the Israel President Herzog visiting anytime soon. Did you see that?
I did say that, and this does speak to the complexity of the matter because, of course, just as not everyone in the Indigenous community thinks the same way, everyone in Jewish community don't think the same way. There's a real diversity of views, and there are a number of Jewish groups that are very critical of the Israeli government. President Herzog's a very interesting character. He was previously a Labour Party politician in Israel, and for those who've not been that close to the issue, Labour Party was the party that was probably more pro-peace, you could say, probably more inclined. Ehud Barak was the last major prime minister from the Labour Party, but like many politicians, his career's gone in a whole range of different directions, and he made some very controversial comments. I think he might have said there was no innocent civilians in Gaza, and I think that upset a lot of people. He has since walked that back, but people saw that as inciting violence against civilians. So that's the origin of that call, for him not to come, Michael. It would be interesting if he was to come here. Does that inflame tensions, or is it a healing device? I don't know. It could go either way, Michael. You can only imagine if Benjamin Netanyahu came here.
Well, for a lot of people who are old enough, it takes them back to all sorts of things. Shouldn't compare anti-Semitism with apartheid, but in some ways you can about some of these big issues. Australians rise up against white rugby teams coming here back in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, I think you can expect that a lot of people, including these Jewish groups, will come out to protest about Herzog being here. We just have to hope again that works in a peaceful way. But looking forward, Martin, and going back to your first comments, what do you hope does come out of the Royal Commission?
I think there's a number of things. Firstly, there's an elephant in the room that no one wants to address, and that's that anti-Semitism is a real issue, but it's also people have a right to express political views, particularly make governments accountable. So you can never restrict the right for legitimate criticism of the Israeli government. So where does anti-Semitism and its interaction with commentary on Israel and Gaza what's appropriate and fair and legitimate. There was a cartoon by Kathy Wilcox which garnered a lot of attention recently. There's flashpoints about this issue all over the place at the moment. It would be helpful for us to reflect on where can we legitimately criticize actions, extreme violence, for instance, and where it's incumbent upon us to protect, the well-being of communities here in Australia. So I think that's actually quite a thorny issue, Michael, and I don't think it's been addressed.
So, yes, defining what anti-Semitism is going to be one of the huge challenges. But beyond that, I suppose there'll be a review of Australia's sort of racial hate laws. We've already got provisions in the Racial Discrimination Act, but it gives the opportunity to review all of that. And we've touched on the fact that people will want to know how these two guys could have gone off to the Philippines, how they could have got back here. And how they weren't picked up along the way.
Yeah, well, it was not that long ago there was a discussion around weakening or, watering down our racial hate laws. Michael, where we've all been around long enough to remember that. Now there's discussions around how to tighten it. So it really does show that there's a role for regulating racial hate. Trying to land that and pair that with freedom of speech, always tricky.
Well, Martin, this is a topic which we'll be following for some time to come. We haven't left it, but we'll just move to another big topic that's been happening, and you sort of can't believe it has happened, and that is the US under President Donald Trump authorizing their military to fly into Caracas, Venezuela, nabbing the head of state and his wife, and ferrying them off to New York, where he's charged with all sorts of alleged narco crimes, as they call them. This sort of imperial push by Donald Trump probably shouldn't take anyone by great surprise. Back on the 9th of December, Fremantle Shipping News published an interesting piece in the Seeing Red column of Barry Healy's called "Trump's U.S. Imperialism Inc. Redraws the Map," and that's all based on a statement about what their security strategy is in the US, where it was all set out. I tell people that I think it's nine parts Stephen Miller and one part the guy who runs the Heritage outfit in the US, and Donald Trump sort of signs off on it. But were you as astonished as I was, but in some ways not, by the Venezuelan sortie?
I'm not really surprised much more any longer about Donald Trump, but I still think this is absolutely extraordinary because this is a president that was touting his peace credentials for much of 2025, if you recall, Michael. And both you and I stated it was good to have a president that was at least interested in peace or stating his desire for peace.
Well, I wanted to give him the prize, but
You were you, you I said wait and see. I'm feeling a bit vindicated. But I thought that was good. He was interested in peace, but this is entirely in the opposite direction. Usually when a US president goes and knocks off, some corrupt administration in Central America, they trumpet this as a move for democracy, Michael, and they say we're giving, the country back to the people. That's not even a claim here, really. Trump has not really talked about democracy in Venezuela. Its justification is to stop the drug importation into the US, and he claims Maduro is behind that. But just arresting the president himself and his wife won't change all of that if that's his sole motive. But he's been very open about controlling the oil coming out of Venezuela. And he's been also really open about it benefiting the US and US companies. So it's very hard to deny that this is a really imperialist takeover of that is attempting anyway of Venezuela and to force their hand. And so it's very hard to deny that oil is really at the center of this.
It absolutely is correct what you say, Martin. I actually stayed up to the early hours of the morning to watch the live vision with Donald Trump, with Rubio behind him and Hegseth there as well. And everything I've read since tell me that Marco Rubio has been pushing this for a long time. But the idea, which they had previously tried to sell, that this wasn't about regime change, it was just about enforcing US law against a criminal, albeit one who's the president, lawfully or not, of a country, Venezuela. I mean, the light was given to it all very quickly by Trump. It was all about the oil. It was all about putting the US companies in. It was being paid back for what we had stolen from us. But there's no real, it seems, answer for the governance on the ground. And you'll be
Well,
reading what I'm reading, and there's all of these groups. It looks like Iraq all over again.
this is what's flabbergasts me. So it's in one sense it was a well-executed abduction, if you like, arrest, whatever legitimate or illegitimate language you want to put on it, of the president, right? But what happens next? There was no thought or anything that appears to be put into place around the governance of this country. The vice president's taken over for now. We don't know for how long. What will Trump do next? He's basically said he's running the show there. Can't see him running the show really. There's no troops on the ground in Venezuela, not that we know of. There might be CIA, Michael, but. We're not seeing this. And so the next steps are really, really interesting here. I think it's definitely supposed to be a warning shot to other countries that that the US doesn't like either. So, Colombia was certainly pointed out. And of course, we're going to come at some stage to that lovely Northern Ireland called Greenland.
Well, let's talk about Greenland. It seems that, if anything, the foot's been pushed down harder on the Greenland pedal. People keep saying there's only tens of thousands of these people, and the fact that they're connected historically in governance or sovereignty terms with Denmark matters not a jot. We want them to run our security systems out so we can deal with, amongst others, the Russians. I mean, it just seems absurd to me, but you can't say anything so absurd that it won't happen under the Trump regime. I mean, it's an imperial dream the man's got.
This is even more astonishing. Now, when he first raised the Greenland question, I think we did discuss this, Michael, and I was fairly dismissive. I must say, I thought, well, NATO allies governing this territory. It's not, you can't say it's, the elections are contested or it's a corrupt dictatorship or you've got none of those precursors, if you like. It just seemed to me to be some kind of throwaway line. But it's being pursued by the US administration. And Europe is really alarmed by this. And this is the extraordinary part. There's every chance that this will cause a really serious rift between major European powers and the US. If you've got a country in Western Europe, liberal democracy in Western Europe, whose territory, they're semi-autonomous in Greenland, is suddenly taken over. US has said they want to buy countries. I mean, that's something you did in the early 18th century, Michael. I don't think you no, you don't buy countries with people in it these days. Usually you tend to at least ask those people what they think. The other part of this too, Michael, and we'll see how this plays out. This adds legitimacy to China's attempts to take over Taiwan, to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and any other imperialist power that just thinks that they can take over someone else's country.
It totally does, doesn't it? Martin, the NATO setup, of course, really all flows from the Marshall Plan. After the war, it was important to stop these countries, particularly the area of Germany, Poland, and beyond, not becoming part of what they in fact became, many of them, part of the other side of the Iron Curtain. They became part of the USSR. Money was put in, economies was saved or redeveloped. And now there isn't that same economic motivation, is there, to maintain Western Europe or that greater part of Europe that's in NATO? So you can sort of see it slipping away. And it's only on the 4th of July this year, 2026, the US will be 250 years on from the making of the Declaration of Independence. So they've had 250 years as an imperial country. Over 100 years ago, they did the Monroe Doctrine to let the South Americans know they were serious. They also took over the Philippines. There seems to be no end to what they're prepared to do. And I've been thinking to myself, does he think he's, at least Julius Caesar or someone else, and he wants to emulate the Roman Empire? The Roman Empire, at its best, lasted 500 years, Martin.
Oh, I think if he got 500 years, I think he'd be pretty happy. But yeah, there's a whole range of other unanswered questions. How do people in the Republican Party feel about this? Because the Republican Party is traditionally, it's got plenty of non-interventionist people as well as war hawks. It's got Lindsey Graham who are war hawks, and it's got Rand Paul's that are non-interventionist. Michael, does he start eventually getting some pushback into his from his own side of politics here in the US? Because I mean, there hasn't been a lot of that. I should say though that the Senate, this is the US Senate, has passed a resolution just in the last 24 hours, insisting on them approving further military action in Venezuela, and this received the support of all the Democrats but five Republican senators, including Rand Paul and a couple of others. So, there is some resistance here, and if that was passed by the House, there'd be a lot of pressure on Trump. You've got the whole of Congress then, in effect, making their opinions clear. So I wonder if that some pushback in the US at a time when, they've got severe economic problems of their own, and this adventurism, people start questioning his priorities.
Well, my American friends, of course, cast the whole issue in other terms again, and that's to say, we've got the Republic, we've had it for 250 years, and it's been well understood how it works. There are checks and balances, there are three arms of governmental power, and that's being destroyed around us. And going to war or doing the Venezuela sortie without congressional approval was one of them. Rubio said, of course, oh, we couldn't tell you anything in Congress because you leak, and they would have found out what we were about to do. I mean, this is Trump just believes, and he's just made an interview with the New York Times, and basically seems to believe that if he thinks it's right, regardless of international law or any other strictures on executive power. But Martin, this all raises for me a question. Should Australia not be sitting up as a polity and saying, do we want to continue to be dealing with a country like the United States that behaves like this? Do we want to maintain our contract under AUKUS to buy those submarines? Should we go back to the French?
These are really good questions, very profound questions. In Australia, I think Anthony Albanese has worked pretty successfully, I guess, to keep up good relationship with the US administration, principally because the money the Australian government's already invested in AUKUS, and they've sent billions towards, they've already been funding the start of this partnership, but also for tariffs and other reasons. So it does present a lot of dilemmas. Australia is deeply invested in a security sense in the US. You've got US bases here in Australia, etc. But I think there'll be plenty of decision makers who are deeply uncomfortable. They're used to an existing a world view that Australia's always US has always got your back, etc. But if a US president's quite unpredictable, these things become harder.
Well, Martin, it's going to be very interesting 2026. As they say, may you live in interesting times. I'd much say, much prefer to have a quiet, calm existence myself, but I suppose the international strategist in you must think, bring it on.
Oh, well, I mean, I always enjoy a bit of plenty of liveliness in national, international politics and the like. They are disquieting times, I think, that we live in.
Martin, we don't have time apart from reflecting on the fact there's going to be a federal royal commission into to Bondi and anti-Semitism to reflect on any state or local politics. But I think we can and should come back to what's going on locally in state and Fremantle terms next Friday.
I think it would be good. The start of the year is always a good one to look at priorities at all levels, and I think that's probably worth just unpacking that a little bit and seeing what we think, in the crystal ball might be there for 2026.
Well, if we are both here at the end of next week, Martin, and the world is still populated by humans who haven't destroyed themselves yet, we'll do that. I'll see you
Look
then.
forward to it.